Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Middle East Studies. I'm James Dorsey, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Ellen Wald about her new book, Saudi Inc., The Arabian Kingdom's Pursuit of Profit and Power. Ellen Wald, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. Perhaps we can kick off with you giving us a little bit of an intellectual biography of yourself.
Sure. Where do we start? Let's start. I did my undergraduate degree at Princeton University, where I studied history and Near Eastern studies. I also actually studied creative writing as well, and I worked with Professor Mike Duran for my senior independent work. And then I went on to graduate school at Boston University, where I also studied history. I did a PhD in history. But there I actually had the opportunity to work with an economist and a specialist in international relations or diplomatic history, Andrew Bacevich. And I was very, very interested in business history, really, the history of businesses, how businesses interact with government, the relationship between government and business, often kind of launching from this in this post New Deal era. What kind of relationships do the American government have with businesses? I was very interested, for example, in the Marshall Plan. In fact, I almost wrote my dissertation about the Marshall Plan. Luckily, I was dissuaded from doing that, and I instead decided to look at how American and British businesses interact with the government when they are overseas. I kind of fused my interest in both diplomatic history and also business history. And when I've always been interested in the Middle East in particular, I've studied Farsi. In particular, I've studied a little Arabic, but more Farsi. And I, when you're looking at businesses, particularly Western businesses in the Middle East, you're really looking at oil companies. And I was looking at them in the 40s and the 50s in this post-New Deal era. And so I really focused my dissertation on American and British oil companies that were in the Middle East in the 1940s and 50s, and in particular, two companies, Aramco, the Arabian American Oil Company in Saudi Arabia, and the AIOC, or the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, which is now BP, in Iran. And so my dissertation focused on mostly these two companies, but also other interactions during the World War II period between oil men and the government and how they formed a relationship. Particularly, I talked about something I called mutual insurance, which was how the two the businesses and the government developed a particular relationship that served both their interests and how that relationship worked overseas, particularly in the Middle East. And that, in turn, led to really the genesis of what became this book.
Before we get in, well, first of all, I guess you couldn't have chosen a more fascinating interaction between government and business than the Arabian American Oil Company and the way that it evolved into becoming the Saudi National Oil Company. But before we get into the details of that, perhaps it would be interesting if you would, I know this goes beyond the book, but nonetheless, whether you could draw a comparison in the way that the four American oil companies that were shareholders in the Arabian American Oil Company, which was the predecessor to the to Aramco, the Saudi National Oil Company, how those four companies compared in the way that they did business to the British oil company in Iran.
And that's a fantastic question, because that was so, so important in also in how the relationship between the Americans and the Saudis developed, as opposed to how the relationship between the British and the Iranians developed. And there were a lot of other differences. The British had been there much earlier, but really the Americans who went into Saudi Arabia were very conscious. Those four American oil companies, we're talking about Standard Oil of New Jersey and Standard Oil of New York, Standard Oil of California, and Texaco. Standard Oil of New Jersey became Exxon, Standard Oil of New York became Mobil, and now they're one company, Exxon Mobil, and Standard Oil of California became Chevron. So those four oil companies formed this subsidiary called Aramco, the Arabian American Oil Company, which was a separate company, but it was those were the four shareholders until the Saudis began to buy it out. But they were very, very conscious of what was going on in Iran. And in fact, they were trying desperately not to do what the British did to Iran. And in fact, the State Department was often in communication with them, and they were looking at what was happening in Iran and saying to these men who were in Saudi Arabia dealing with the Saudis, saying, are you seeing any signs of the Saudis reacting to you the way the Iranians are reacting to the British? Because if you are, we're going to be in trouble, because it's not that the American government or the American people needed that oil in the 50s when all of the problems were happening in Iran, but they needed that oil to go to Western Europe to fuel the rebuilding from the war. And they needed that oil because they were using it to fuel their military planes in Korea and in Japan. So it wasn't so much, you know, the American public gasoline prices are going to go up, but it was definitely seen as a strategic imperative to have that Saudi oil. And they were very, very concerned and were often kind of pushing the Americans in some ways to be much more accommodating of the Saudis, precisely because of what they saw, because the British were so antagonistic towards the Iranians. They were so intransigent. They refused to consider what the Iranians were asking for. The Iranians were originally just asking for more. They were asking for a larger cut of the profits from their oil. And the guy who was in charge of the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company at the time, William Fraser, was very intransigent, and he was really very opposed to negotiating, and he just put his foot down. And the Iranians reacted by nationalizing the oil company. And by the time Fraser and the British were willing to talk, the Iranians were so far gone that they were not going to talk. They wanted nothing short of nationalization. And the Americans were very conscious of this and were constantly saying to the American oil men, you know, are there signs of this? You need to be careful.
Obviously, the historical trajectories, or comparing the historical trajectories of Saudi Arabia and Iran, is comparing apples and pears. But one other difference, I think, or maybe because of that, of course, one other difference is that the role of the original oil company, so the American Arabian Oil Company in Saudi Arabia and the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company in Iran, and the role that they played in the formation of the state and the development of the state are very different. In many ways, Aramco probably was far more central to the involvement of Saudi Arabia as a state than the Anglo-British Oil Company was to Iran.
Precisely. And you know, there was really no other industry in Saudi Arabia at the time. And, you know, they had nothing. The only other source of profit or of revenue, really, the only other source of revenue for the the only other source of revenue for the Saudis was Hajj. And that really wasn't bringing them very much in terms of revenue, in terms of taxes. And they were living essentially a pre-modern life in Saudi Arabia. They had very, very little before the oil industry. And Iran, by contrast, was a vibrant, you know, economy that had a lot going for it outside of the oil industry. Yes, the oil industry employed a lot more Iranians and was a very large percentage of their economy. I don't have the figures in front of me, but it was a very large percentage. But they had all sorts of other things going for them. And they also had a much more developed government. They had majlis, you know, they had a parliament. The Saudis were really just a monarchy. I mean, we're talking about an old style monarchy with almost no bureaucracy as well.
I guess the what if question was, how would Saudi Arabia would have developed if Aramco hadn't been there?
They really would not have had any way to modernize, essentially. They had no industry. They had no way to modernize. And the Saudi king, I mean, they knew it. That's the important thing, is that the Saudis knew that they needed Aramco. And they knew, once they realized that they had this oil, they knew they had the oil, but they knew that they didn't have the expertise to develop it. It's like I always say, oil is worth nothing unless you can process it and get it to someone who can put it in their car. Otherwise, it's just black gook that can light on fire. And it seemed that the Saudis were cognizant of the fact that although they were sitting on this pile of black gold, and they called it God's gift, but they lacked the expertise to develop it. And so they knew they needed the Americans. Likewise, the Americans, the oil men, knew that they needed the Saudis, because without that access, because ultimately, when it came down to it, the Saudis controlled access to their oil. They were, you know, the sovereigns of the country. And so no matter what kind of disagreements they were having, it all boiled down to that fact, and that they needed each other to work with each other. Now, over time, and the Saudis did put a lot of effort into gaining the expertise that they needed to run this oil company. And so once that expertise was developed, that's when they began to actually buy out the company. And the Saudis learned from Iran too. It's very interesting, because both the Americans were learning from the Iranian situation, but the Saudis saw what happened to the Iranian government when they nationalized their oil company, but they weren't ready to run it. And they ended up having this terrible embargo on them. They lost a ton of money. And for the Iranians, the nationalization and the ownership was much more important to them, because they had had this history of Western powers coming in and taking control of their resources. They had it in the early 1900s with the tobacco protests. So they had this experience with colonialism and imperialism that the Saudis didn't really have. And so the Saudis didn't necessarily see the Americans in the same way as the Iranians saw the British. So they didn't necessarily feel that they needed to nationalize for their own, for their own sake. They were much more interested in just making money. And they knew that if they took the oil company from the Americans and they did it in a violent way, or they did it too soon, they would lose money. And they always were keeping their eye on profit. That was their main goal.
The Saudis also being all about regime survival, and that was probably what you were referring to, were also looking at, after the nationalization of the oil company Iran, at the U.S.-British backed 1953 coup in Iran.
They were. I think that they, in many senses, kind of saw it as like a kind of, well, what did they expect was going to happen? They always kind of had this, at least in the documents that I was reading, had this almost like bemused way of looking at it. Like, well, what did they think was going to happen? And so they were always definitely making it. There were times when they threatened nationalization because they knew the effect it would have on the Americans, but not because they really believed that they could actually run the oil industry. I mean, we're talking about 1952, 1953. And so there were Saudis who were working for the oil company, but not in any, you know, positions of executive positions.
You mentioned early on that the U.S. government, the State Department particularly, was very conscious of what was happening in Iran and concerned to some degree that the same could happen in Saudi Arabia, and therefore advising the American oilmen to be accommodating. Yet, at least for a fairly significant period of time, the attitude, as I interpret your what you've been, the history that you wrote, the attitude of the oilmen was one of condescending of the Saudis, underestimating the Saudis, and even being deceitful in the way that they were doing business.
Constantly. I mean, they didn't want to end up in an intractable position with nationalization like the Iranians, but the Americans did not see these people, did not see the Saudis as equals in any way, shape, or form. And they were definitely trying to deceive them. They didn't think that they, you know, knew as much, and that they didn't think that they knew what was good for them. They definitely had very, I would say, typical, you know, Western attitudes towards Saudis, particularly the executives. Later on, and a lot of the Americans, maybe like Americans who worked for the company in the 60s and in the 70s. So we're talking about 60s and 70s. These were Americans who were working with Saudis who also worked for the company, who were climbing the ranks, had very different opinions of the Saudis. So I don't want to make it sound like this is a blanket statement. That I'm talking more about the executives or the diplomats in a sense. But those who were working, I've spoken to many people who said, you know, I worked with this, you know, Saudi guy. He was a great boss, you know, because at first, you know, because eventually the Saudis, you know, rose to the ranks and became executives in the company. So those who were working for the company, I think they had, for the most part, very good relations. Part of that is due to the fact that Aramco was run essentially like an American company. And so I've had, you know, I've spoken to Saudis who told me, you know, oh, they made us all, we thought there were some tension between the Saudis and the Americans. So they made us all go on this retreat, this like business peeps treat. And we had to like talk about our feelings and, you know, the kind of thing that they'll send you off to, or they send, you know, the executives off to it in corporations. And it's like, it was just like, you know, what they would do at Exxon if there were, you know, with management. So there's definitely that. But in the early days, the Americans definitely thought they could pull one over on the Saudis. And there's this very interesting incident that happened in the 50s. They had renegotiated their concession agreement to essentially move away from the typical just royalties to what they called a 50-50 a 50-50 profit sharing, where they worked out by way of several different kinds of taxes that essentially the Saudis and the Americans would the Saudi government and the oil company would split the profits 50-50. But then the very kind of crafty and I would say shrewd finance minister was looking at exactly how much money the Aramco was selling the oil at different points because Aramco would sell all of its oil to the four shareholding companies. And he was looking at these discrepancies between what Aramco was selling their oil for and what these companies were paying and then what they were selling it for. And he thought that the Saudis were being cheated in this transaction. So he actually went and he brought in an American consulting company called De Gaulle and MacNaughton. De Gaulle and MacNaughton is actually still around today. In fact, they were the company that was hired by Saudi Aramco to audit their reserves in preparation for their IPO. So they're a very old, well-known company, and the Saudi government hired them to come and sit in and be on the negotiations. And so when the Americans got to the negotiating table, they're stunned to see these Americans that a lot of them know and have worked with sitting on the side of these Saudi bureaucrats arguing against them. And yet they were very successful. And the Americans had to admit that, yes, they were kind of cheating the Saudis. And they had to, they ended up reaching a more equitable agreement.
I don't know if this is true, but I walked away from reading certainly the early history with a notion as if the Saudis really from early on had a long-term strategy in terms of building up the cult company, building up Saudi capabilities and Saudi developing Saudi nationals who would ultimately be able to take over the company, a long-term strategy in terms of participation, related to the royalties and the revenues that they would be reaping, but then also in terms of gradually building up the ownership and before finally then acquiring the company. Is that a correct impression?
That's exactly what I wanted to show in the book, because I think that there was a long-term plan. And a lot of that had to do, like you mentioned before, with preservation of the monarchy, because pretty early on, they realized that this was their ticket, that this oil was their ticket. But it wasn't just the oil, because like I said, they saw what happened in Iran and how Iran had all this oil. But if they couldn't get it out of the ground and they couldn't get it out of the country, they weren't going to make any money from it. And so there was definitely the Saudi monarchy has always, or at least maybe until recently, looked at their survival in the long term. Everything they do is for like the next generation or to generations to come. It's not necessarily, they're not looking at, say, their next quarterly report, like a lot of companies, you know, are looking to just, you know, are our quarterly results next month better than this month? So, but the Saudis are looking in the long term. And it started with the monarchy looking in the long term, saying, you know, King Abdulaziz Ibn Saud saying he's finally got this. He struggled and struggled for so many years. He's finally got this essentially like a windfall. And yet, you know, this is not really for him. It's for his children or his children's children, for his sons. And his sons were the ones who ruled Saudi Arabia. The monarchy is passed from brother to brother to brother, not eldest son to eldest son. And so they saw this as a very important way, their legacy for future generations. And so there was always this, but that this idea that, well, maybe we could make a lot more money right away if we did X, but we can make a lot more money in the long term if we stick it out, if we send our kids to school and they become geologists and petroleum engineers and we have them work for this company and, you know, then they will take over. Eventually, we will buy out the company. And not all of that was conceived, obviously, by, you know, Abdulaziz Ibn Saud. I don't think he foresaw that at all. But there were people working for him who did. Suleiman, who was the he was the finance minister, Abdullah Suleiman, who was the finance minister, definitely had an idea that that was something that could be done. And he was the first one to ask for Saudi board membership. He wanted Saudis to be on the board of Aramco. And he didn't end up getting it, but his successors did end up getting Saudi board membership. And they kind of built on that, learned how things worked. And then eventually, when the time came and they made a lot of money, they used it then to just buy out the company. And by the time they'd gotten to that point in the early 70s, it was pretty clear that the American owners were seeing the writing on the wall, that they realized that at a certain point they were either going to be nationalized or, but they could get more out of it if they sold. And so instead they had a, what everyone described to me as a very amicable buyout takeover, the details of which unfortunately are not all public. Mostly because Aramco was a private company. It was registered in Delaware, but it was technically a private company. So we don't know all the details. I actually had the opportunity to talk to the American CEO at the time of the final buyout agreement. And he's very, very old. And I asked him, I said, so how much did they pay you finally? Like, how much was the company worth back then? And he wouldn't tell me. So there are some details that we don't really know about it, but there was always definitely this long-term plan to buy out the company in the end. And because of the way that they did that, and because they went slowly and they were able to kind of hold back and be patient, they were able to make a lot more money because the process of the buyout was so undisruptive. Everyone said, we had no idea that, you know, one day we were working for an American company and then the next day we were working for a Saudi company, but we had no idea.
If I recall correctly, you use a figure of $2 billion in 1970s terms as a valuation of the company.
That was something that was reported, I believe, by Mies at the time, but it was unconfirmed.
Mies Economic Survey.
Yeah. And it was unconfirmed. So, you know, that's what they think that they may have paid for it. But we don't have the we do know that there was also a deal by which the four shareholders, American shareholders, were still able to buy oil from, they were guaranteed, I think, certain prices and certain amounts of oil from the Saudis for a certain amount of time, because that was a particular point for those companies to have access to that oil.
One other possible explanation of the differences in the Saudi approach and the Iranian approach is, of course, the fact that the Saudis, being concerned about regime survival, were always more dependent on external forces than the Iranians were.
Well, exactly. I mean, the Saudis did not really have an army, so to speak of. You know, they had enough. You know, they had kind of their internal forces, and Abdul Aziz would, you know, send out some of his sons to put down rebellions occasionally, but they had no, you know, no real army to speak of if there was a regional conflict. And that really came out in the Gulf War, where they really had to invite the Americans in to defend them. And in particular, their oil industries were really on the line there. It was not far away. And the Aramco, which was then owned by the Saudis, essentially provided most of the oil and the jet fuel that the Americans were using and that the other allies were using to bomb Iraq when they were leaving from Saudi Arabia, and they were using their oil.
If I can interrupt, you're referring to the 1991 Iraq war when the Iraqis invaded Kuwait.
Yes, in 1990-1991. Yes. Yes, I'm referring to that war. So Aramco actually provided all of the oil and jet fuel for the bombings.
This, you don't refer to this in the book, but I want to throw it at you anyways. Tim Niblock, the political economist in Britain, who has done a lot of work on political economy in the Gulf, he at one point argued that the Saudis had essentially adopted the Taiwan model in the development of their oil as well as their petrochemicals industry, in terms of having a bureaucracy that was independent of the oil company, which may not have been quite the case in terms of Aramco, but it's certainly not corrupt and much more attuned to the needs of the business, as opposed to other sectors of the economy.
So that's a really interesting point. I'm not hugely familiar with his work, but he's definitely definitely onto something there, because Aramco is unique amongst, I would say, all Gulf oil companies and other national oil companies as well, in that it operates independently from the Saudi government. And I don't mean totally independently. I mean, there's still influence. There's an oil ministry, and the oil ministry is the ministry that really deals with setting production quotas. It's, deals with OPEC and things like that. But what I mean is that in other countries like Iran, at the NIOC, or Kuwait with the Kuwait Oil Company, the government runs the oil company. So, like you said, like their bureaucrats are the ones who are running the oil company. And when the NIOC, for example, the National Iranian Oil Company, sells oil, that money all goes through the Iranian Central Bank. And this is actually a huge problem with the sanctions right now, is that they control all of the money. And so the money goes to the government, and then the government decides how much money the oil company is going to get. And that's not the case at all with Aramco, because Aramco operates independently. Aramco sells its oil. Aramco collects the money. The money goes to Aramco. And then Aramco pays taxes and, you know, royalties and things like that to the government, but they pay it in taxes. And this was a very important point. And actually, when I was in Saudi Arabia, and I went to Aramco, and I had the opportunity to sit down with Ali Al-Naimi, who was he was the first Saudi CEO of Aramco, and then he was also oil minister for many years. And I had the opportunity to ask him about this, because he had written an autobiography, but it was a little hazy on this point of, you know, what exactly happened. And there was this transition period in the 1980s where Aramco was actually owned by the Saudis, but it was still registered in Delaware. It was still an American company. And then in 1988, they formally transferred it to Saudi Arabia. And so Ali Al-Naimi said that during that time, the finance ministry actually fought very hard to kind of get Aramco under their jurisdiction. And Naimi went, and he went to the king, and he said, "We can't have this. You cannot have an oil company that is where the money doesn't come to them, and they don't get to make decisions about their budget, because we'll never be able to expand. We won't be able to do what's best for the kingdom." And Ali Al-Naimi had a very particular vision for what Aramco could become that was far beyond what the American shareholders had thought. And I think that he understood that if the money was going to the government, in particular the finance ministry, that they were just going to take it and use it for what they wanted. And they weren't going to be able to put it into invest into capital expenditures the way that he wanted. He said, "You can't have an oil company that doesn't have control of its money." And that was really the key difference, I think, between Aramco and between other oil, national oil companies, is that they are so independent, or they had been for many, many years. In fact, if you want to talk about controversy, I've actually written about this, but I see some changes happening now as the Saudi leadership is moving to the next generation that are really trying to take the decision making away from Aramco. And in my mind, at least, and I think that I show in the book that in many respects, it was that independence and the ability to pursue this vision to maximize long-term profit that has really made Aramco so successful, and by virtue of Aramco's success, has not just made Saudi Arabia a success, but really made the Saudi monarchy a success, and really kept them in power.
I want to come back to what you just referred to in terms of Aramco today and its whole place in what's happening in Saudi Arabia and the reforms. But before we do that, one of the other themes that I think comes out in your book very strongly is, in a sense, political expediency. With other words, that the Saudis consistently almost strictly kept a Chinese wall between their oil industry and the politics of the region. So in 1940, So in 1948, when Israel was founded, the Saudis did not react in terms of using their oil leverage. And by the same token, 1973, even though it was projected as an embargo against the United States and the Netherlands because of the 1973 war and U.S. support for Israel, in effect, it really was part of the strategy or an opportunity that arose in the whole Saudi strategy to take over Aramco.
Exactly. I mean, that's exactly right. For the Saudis, it's always been much more about money than it has been about politics, in particular, the incredible politics of the Middle East. And for the Saudis, for the Saudis, it's always been more about money than it has been about politics. I don't want to say that politics has never come into play, and it certainly has, but they're never going to do something to actively hurt their chances of making money just for a political reason or an ideological reason. So, even now, if the Americans are saying, oh, we want to put pressure on Iran, so we need to keep oil prices low, so can you produce more oil? The Saudis, are aligned in terms of their political interests there. But if there's not money to be made with producing more oil and selling it, then they're probably not going to do it. They're not going to just do it for the sake of politics. They'll do it for money and politics, or they'll do it for money. And that's something that I think has really been lost or subsumed in when we're looking at narratives of the Middle East, because we're so focused on ideology. And that ideology was a huge motivator in 1973 when it came to Iran, when it came to Egypt, when it came to Libya. But for the Saudis, it was something that turned out to be convenient for them. And it was something they couldn't really get out of because they did have these alliances with these other countries. But it was something that helped their overall scheme in terms of business. And so and I wanted to bring that business aspect back to say, this is what's really motivating them. And this is a consistent theme throughout.
One could argue that manipulating, balancing the oil price, being the swing producer, was as much political as it was commercial, because Saudi Arabia, also in terms of regime survival, certainly had an interest in being a key ally to Western powers. And in terms of its utility, it was that ability to influence the oil price, or to influence the amount of oil available.
I would say that definitely helped. But I think when we talk about Saudi Arabia as a swing producer, we have to be careful, because they very much during the 80s, they tried very hard to be a swing producer. And I think they found that you can really only be a swing producer in certain cases. And there were times where they kept trying to basically swing lower. So Saudi would cut their oil production when the rest of OPEC wasn't necessarily cutting, in an attempt to push up oil prices. And in that case, they were just not able to do it. I mean, it was not, there were years where it was very difficult for them. They were losing a lot of money. They were trying to be this swing producer, but there were all other sources of oil. There was oil coming out of the North Sea. There was oil coming out of Alaska, and all these other OPEC producers, in the Gulf and in Venezuela, were producing a lot themselves. And the Saudis really ended up losing out trying to play swing producer when it really wasn't possible. So they're able to swing in certain situations when it can help them, and it can definitely help them politically without a doubt. But there are other situations where it's just not possible, because even though they have incredible productive capacity, they have incredible reserves, they have the best, I would say, the best oil company in the world. They have the most accessible and cheap to produce oil in the world. But when there are a lot of other sources of oil out there, they just can't necessarily control the market.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, in writing the history of Aramco, you're in a lot of ways writing the history of Saudi Arabia. And maybe you can talk a little bit about, on the one hand, you describe certainly in the earlier days a much more a conservative but still much more liberal society than the way we perceive Saudi Arabia today. Among other things, you mentioned that the banning of alcohol really came out of an incident in a bar rather than out of a religious conviction. I think the one place where I would take issue with what you wrote was in terms of Saudi funding of what I would call ultra-conservative Islam globally. The relationship with the Muslim Brotherhood, in my mind, which you lumped together with Al-Qaeda and others, I think was much more complex on the one hand. And on the other hand, if you really look at the Saudi funding, the overwhelming bulk of it did not go to violent groups. But there are about five countries where it deliberately went to violent groups, even until today. And so I thought that you were, I realize it was only a couple of pages, but nonetheless.
Oh, I agree with you. There's definitely a bit of kind of glossing over of that particular aspect, precisely because, you know, the book was not an exploration of that topic, which in and of itself, you know, could be many books. So I absolutely agree. I think the overall point I was trying to make was that at least at this point, they absolutely have funded these groups. But over time, I think they came to realize that political Islam poses a great threat to their own monarchy. And they realize that these people are trying to overthrow them. And so they are now taking these things much more seriously. And really, you know, they do have absolute authority and at least in Saudi Arabia are shutting down anything that they perceive as an Islamic-based threat to their power because you know, the type of political Islam that the Muslim Brotherhood want to see or other radical groups want to see is not the Saudi monarchy. And they realized, I think it took them quite a while, but eventually they came to see these groups as threatening to them.
I want to go, if we can, for a moment, beyond the book, and you referenced that before, and that's Aramco's obviously been in the news in the last 2 years because of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's reform programs and the way that he made a privatization of a small part of Aramco almost a cornerstone of his reform plans. And maybe you can talk a little bit about that and in terms of how important Aramco is to the economic reforms, what the delay in the planned sale of a 5% stake means for the reform plans.
Sure. So I'm probably going to give a different take on this from other analysts. And my take is really that the Crown Prince came out there, and this was before he was Crown Prince, and he really talked about the sale of a portion of Aramco as a cornerstone of his economic diversification and economic transformation plan. And he put it out there like that. But when you look at what they're trying to do and what the Saudi economy really needs, the Aramco sale is really not a particularly integral role in what is actually or what will actually help to wean the kingdom off of their addiction to oil. Aramco is, you know, a money-making machine for the Saudis. And it's also kind of a cornerstone in terms of the development of other industries in Saudi Arabia, particularly the petrochemicals industry, but they also do what they can to attract other manufacturing. I know they try to attract manufacturers that use their products to come and manufacture in Saudi Arabia. But what's really that Saudi Arabia has problems. I mean, every country has problems, but Saudi Arabia's got problems. And one of some of the problems in particular are that its economy is very, and its employment are very much reliant on the state. Most people are employed by the state, and its businesses are very much dependent on the state, businesses that are not Aramco. And so this is a huge problem for, you know, for the Saudi economy. They need private businesses. They need to either attract foreign businesses to come to Saudi Arabia and set up shop there. And I know they were trying to. They were trying to get tech companies to come and build data centers there. They want to be a center for logistics. They want to, you know, they want to build Kalashnikovs in Saudi Arabia. They want to do this. But part of the issue is that the state is such a huge presence that they're crowding out other private investment. And so the Aramco sale was supposed to generate money for the Saudi Public Investment Fund, which they wanted to use to then invest in non-oil things, tech things, real estate, you know, all sorts of things. That's not what's supposed to help the Saudi budget. And that's not what's supposed to help the Saudi economy necessarily. That's supposed to generate revenue in the long term, like any other sovereign wealth fund. What's really going to help the Saudi economy is if they actually start privatizing things. Like they actually, he originally saw himself. He said, "I'm like a Saudi Thatcher. I want to sell off these state-owned companies." So far, really, the only sale that they're talking about now is the state-owned portion of SABIC, which is a Saudi petrochemical company that they want to sell to Aramco, which is seems to be what they want to do to raise about $70 billion for their public investment fund to then use to make investments in God knows what they want to invest in now. They invest in all sorts of, I would say, fairly risky tech investments like an augmented reality company or Uber, or they're very into the SoftBank fund. So I don't see that as really driving the economy. I see other changes that they have said they're going to make, like making it easier to start a business, allowing foreigners to open businesses, reducing the time it takes to get a business license. They have a segment of their government that is supposed to, is basically a stimulus plan where they're supposed to be awarding like stimulus money to either foreign companies who want to come in and build things and set up shop. So my take is really that it looks bad for Mohammed bin Salman to walk back something that he said was such a centerpiece. And politically, that could become a problem for him. But when it comes to what's actually going on the ground, if they can actually do what their Vision 2030 plan said it was going to do, even without the Aramco sale, they'll be in much better shape. The question is, are they actually privatizing things? Are they actually helping Saudi start businesses? I mean, they've had this new rule that says, you know, a Saudization of the workforce. Well, fine, so they're kicking out their foreign workers, but are Saudis actually being hired for these jobs? And the data on that is not so clear. So the failure to list Aramco on the New York Stock Exchange may not really have anything to do with the success or failure of Vision 2030.
No, I would agree with that. You talked earlier about Crown Prince bin Salman in some ways trying to gain far greater political control of control of Aramco by the state in ways that Aramco up until then, or up until now, has been able to fend off. It, you know, that meshing of politics and business, if you wish, you mentioned SoftBank. You look at SoftBank's offer to the World Soccer Body, FIFA, of $25 billion. That is purely a political move rather than a commercial move. So you see that on a number of fronts.
And I think it's very difficult. Actually, I wrote an op-ed about this that was in the New York Times a couple months ago. There's some very, very, I think, disturbing signs. I mean, I think all around, you know, Mohammed bin Salman really wants to portray himself as this great reformer. And he uses things like his, you know, decision to allow women to have driver's licenses. But then along with these reforms is an incredible crackdown on civil society in Saudi Arabia, arrests of women who worked for years to try to, you know, achieve this goal. Other women's rights activists just arrested and charged with treason and nothing else. I mean, those are the hallmarks not of someone who is interested in reform, but someone who is interested in power consolidation. And you can see it with Aramco as well. And traditionally, you know, the relationship was always, I think, was not really well defined. And they have structures. And I asked when I was there, you know, how does the government and Aramco work? How do they work together? What's their relationship? And it was explained that Aramco has a board of directors, and their job is to, you know, approve Aramco's, you know, annual plans and whatnot. And then above them is something called the Supreme Aramco Council that is made up of ministers and the king and the crown prince and other, you know, important people and whatnot. And then they approve that and so on and so forth. And but really, I think the relationship could be summed up in this way. And Ali Al-Naimi was the CEO of Aramco. He was called in by King Fahd at that time. So he went to see him, and he thought that King Fahd was going to talk to him about some issues regarding mosque accessibility on Aramco's facility. So at headquarters, at other areas, they had enough mosques, and he had prepared all this information about accessibility of mosques and all of this. And he gets there, and, you know, everything happens at a different time when you get to the royal palace, and he waits. It's finally, you know, like 3 o'clock in the morning, and then the king brings him in, and he doesn't want to talk about mosques. He wants to know, like, how are things going? And Ali Al-Naimi said something like, "Don't worry, I'm running your oil company." It's this kind of this idea that yes, it's maybe owned by the king or owned by the government, but the care of the oil is given to the technocrats, is given to the Aramcons, as they call themselves. And it was always this independent group, and they could make decisions about how they wanted to spend their money, what they wanted to build. And sometimes big things did need to get approval, but it was always kind of a rubber stamp deal. And that seems to be changing, because the crown prince is making really unprecedented input into what the company is doing, how it's spending its money. And that just there seems to be changes in this relationship. And I would argue that may not be the best thing for the survival of the Saudi monarchy, because Aramco has been their cash cow. And yes, they're changing their economy, but that's not going to happen overnight. And you don't want to cut off the hand that feeds you.
Given the indefinite delay of the initial public offering of Aramco, and you mentioned the sale of the petrochemicals company SABIC to Aramco as a way of raising funds. Do you see a private equity sale as a possibility, for example, to the Chinese, either because it's a way of raising funds, but also it's a way of locking in China, in a sense, in terms of long-term supply?
I think that was an idea that was floated probably by the Ministry of Finance. I think I don't see it as really a particularly necessary way of locking in China, because Aramco has already locked in China. They co-own refineries and petrochemical stuff all over China, and they have long-term contracts for their oil. So China is very much entwined with Aramco, and you know, those potentials can grow in terms of the business and are growing. So I'm not sure that they really need to lock in Aramco. Saudi Arabia has always sent a consistent amount of oil to China, and even though, you know, in terms of the amount of oil Saudi Arabia sends there, and Saudi Arabia and Russia have always been China's top suppliers. And sometimes Russia has sent more, sometimes Saudi sent more, but Saudi Arabia has this consistent baseline because of their long-term contracts to these refineries. So I don't see that going anywhere all that soon. I think that they have realized that the private equity sale is not going to necessarily gain them as much as they want. And for the Chinese, there's really not much in it for them. I don't think it's attractive. I don't think the Chinese would see it as attractive because there's no way that they're going to let the Chinese in on any sort of sensitive data or sensitive information about the company, which is really what is or can be seen as very valuable. So the Chinese are really, other than making an investment, which could, you know, appreciate, there isn't a whole lot that's in it for China, I would say.
Ellen, we could go on for another hour, but unfortunately we don't have the time. But before I let you go, what is your next project?
Sure. So I've got a couple things in the fire right now. I'm working on kind of an ebook that provides a very updated look at the company for investors, really. This was Saudi Inc. is really, it's a history book that's designed, you know, for anyone to read. It's a good story. But I'm working on a slightly more technical look at the company as it is in modern times that would be available just as an ebook. And my next history book, it's not under contract, but I am working on a look at right now I call it in my head, how to be a dictator. So I'm looking at, you know, qualities of authoritarian rule over history, and in particular with an eye towards where we see this today and how we can kind of understand what guiding principles are used for authoritarian rulers to both take power and then maintain it, and how that works, particularly in the modern times.
Well, that's certainly something I'd love to come back and do another show with you once the book is out. Thank you very much for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it. All the best.
Thanks for having me.